To Medieval Murder, the podcast that brings all things gruesome and historical to the comfort of your own home or car or wherever it is you're listening from. My name is Hannah Purdyman, and I'm here with my father, Kevin Purdyman, to discuss some of the most famous and infamous murders that took place in the medieval and early modern periods. Medieval Murder came to be first as a blog, then as an Instagram, and now as a podcast after I finished my master's dissertation on homicide in early medieval England. The podcast will feature some of the most famous murders in medieval history, some mini-episode series on different types of medieval murders, and interviews with historians and history enthusiasts alike. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Callum Watson, a specialist in medieval Scottish history. Callum received his PhD at the University of Edinburgh with a thesis entitled Attitudes Towards Chivalry in Barbers Bruce and Harry's Wallace in 2016, and has since been working as a battle master at the Battle of Bannockburn Experience and as a steward at Blackness Castle. Thank you so much for coming on today, Callum.
Thank you for having me. Very exciting to be here and get to explore some juicy medieval murders.
Yeah. So which one do you want to start with today? Because I know we have a bunch.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe the most famous murder in Scottish history, one that's even twice within the last few years gotten to appear on the big screen. In two entirely separate films, is the killing of John Comyn in February 1306, 10th of February 1306. The anniversary is just coming up next month. And I say killing there because, strictly speaking, historians are always a little bit nervous to call it a murder because there's quite a bit of debate and a bit of uncertainty in the sources as to how much it's a sort of premeditated murder and how much it's a sort of crime of passion. But it sparks the kind of final phases of the First War of Scottish Succession, and it propels Robert Bruce, obviously one of the most famous figures from medieval Scottish history, it propels him onto the throne. It's how he starts his tenure as king, which is kind of the worst way that you can start. Yeah, totally. Just knifes his rival in a church, in front of the high altar in a church. So not the most auspicious. That's why historians still debate backwards and forwards as well. How much can he have planned this? That, you know, on the face of it, it doesn't sound like a well thought out plan. You know, if you're going to murder your rival, you want to at least pick somewhere where, you know, ideally folk don't know it was you, but at the very least you don't want to also commit massive sacrilege and get yourself excommunicated as Bruce does. But there are reasons to think that maybe it was premeditated, that this was part of a plan. Not plan A, but that Bruce may have gone into that meeting with Comyn back in February 1306, knowing that one of the possible outcomes might be that he was going to have to kill him.
Okay, yeah.
So Robert Bruce, for anybody who doesn't know, is a claimant to the Scottish throne. Alexander III, a king of Scots, dies in 1286. By accident, he's killed basically in a riding accident, riding through the night from Edinburgh to Fife. And he basically, to all intents and purposes, rides his horse off a cliff. And he leaves behind him an infant granddaughter who at the time lives in Norway. And on her way to Scotland, she gets ill and dies. And so there's a huge succession crisis. And the Bruces, at the time actually Bruce's grandfather, are one of the strongest claimants to the throne.
Okay.
And that's, 1286, it's not till 1290 that Margaret, Alexander's granddaughter, dies. And that's really when the succession crisis starts to heat up and when the Bruces make their first claim. But by 1306, his grandfather's died, his father's died. So from 1304, that claim to the Scottish throne rests in Bruce's hands. And he's in his early 30s by this point. He's about 32, probably 31, coming up to his 32nd birthday by February 1306. And he has most of what we know about what he's been up to in those the kind of early years of his career have all been are all best explained through this ambition to be king. The Bruces aren't recognized as king straight away. John Balliol, who I have to say does have a stronger claim to the throne, you know, on paper by the legal standards of the time, the whole succession crisis is used as an excuse by the English royal administration to interfere in the governance of Scotland, which eventually leads to war. Balliol is kicked off the throne. He's forced to abdicate by the English. And then there's war back and forth. And there are times when the Scots are doing okay, times when the Scots aren't doing okay. There's lots of kind of peaks and troughs. And Bruce has navigated these really by focusing on his ambition to be king. So when the war breaks out, it's not entirely clear what exactly he does in the first year of the war, but initially the family certainly support the English invasion because they think, well, you know, if Balliol gets kicked off the throne, maybe the English will recognize us as king. As it happens, the English aren't really interested anymore in having an independent Scottish king. They think that's been, you know, too much trouble the last 4 years. So they decide they're just going to rule things directly. That causes a lot of popular resentment in Scotland. And Bruce, when the popular rebellions break out in 1297, Bruce is to be found on the patriotic side, fighting against the English for the Scots. Largely, it seems, because with Balliol gone, there's now a kind of big king-shaped hole that Bruce probably feels that, you know, if he can put on a good enough show, if he can, you know, prove that he is a, you know, a capable ruler, maybe this will help get him recognized as king. The problem being, of course, that Balliol is still, you know, he's a prisoner in England. Eventually, he's transferred into papal custody, ends up in France. But he's still out there, and there are plenty of Scots who are still willing to fight and to die and to defend Balliol's cause. So Bruce, he serves as guardian for a bit, so he gets some experience at running things, but he has to share that that guardianship, that office, with John Comyn. The Comyns are relatives of the Balliols. John Balliol is John Comyn's uncle. Now, the Comyns, through the Balliols, do have their own claim to the throne, but really John Comyn, as the Comyns have been for the last sort of century or so, the Comyns have been an enormously influential family, and the Comyns for the Balliols are very much kind of the power behind the throne. You know, their interest is in a Balliol kingship, which lets them maintain their influence, maintain their power. Possibly there are some people who've argued that, you know, John Balliol too has an eye on the throne, but really I would say he's fighting for the Balliol restoration, because he gets all of the benefits of being part of the ruling dynasty without really any of the responsibilities to some extent.
Yeah, there's no risk to that either for them to be.
Yeah, no, precisely, right? By the start of the 14th century, those are the kind of competing factions, if you like, within Scotland. There's Bruce, who wants to be king himself, and you have the kind of wait-and-see Comyn, who is, you know, broadly speaking, he's trying to force the restoration of Balliol. And by 1302, it actually looks like that's quite likely. In 1301... the English launched this big invasion of southern Scotland, and they don't really achieve very much. And at the start, in February again, 1302, the English are actually forced, partly through the failure of their efforts in 1301, partly through French and papal pressure, they are forced to reach a truce, a nine-month truce with the Scots. And there are rumours abound at this time that the King of France is quite eager to use this truce to send John Baliol back into Scotland. And so we might find ourselves then with you know, Baliol back in his kingdom, back on the throne. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is a disaster for Bruce, because if Baliol's back, he can't be king.
Yeah.
We don't know when, but and it's probably quite early on. I mean, it's been suggested as early as the day that truce is agreed, Bruce switches sides and submits to the English, becomes an English lord again. Now, doesn't really have anything to do with Bruce's switching sides, but that plan, or seeming proposed plan to bring Baliol back, falls apart very quickly. The French crown is beaten at the Battle of Courtrai by basically a bunch of Fleming townsmen. Hugely shocking defeat for the French in July, and it shatters the French king's kind of foreign policy altogether. You know, now he's having to put out this bushfire in the Low Countries, and it forces him onto a more kind of peaceable footing with the English. So that hope that the King of France might be able to send Baliol back wrecks it for the Scots. And the following year, now that Edward I, the English king, doesn't have to worry too much about the issues on the continent, he can focus in on Scotland. So he spends 1303 until 1304 in Scotland, basically picking apart Scottish resistance and retaking castles and forcing submissions and so forth. By 1304, the whole of the community has submitted, and Scotland is once again back under English occupation, which is bad news for it's bad news for Baliol, sort of bad news for the Baliol Scots, people like John Comyn, but it seems like great news for Bruce, because that's Baliol now out of the window again, right? Now, once again, he is the best, you know, the last best hope for an independent King of Scots.
So is his plan to go in and try to get out from under English occupation and take the country as king?
Yeah, so I mean, fundamentally, he just wants to be king. And if he could get the English to just plant him in place, he would take that. You know, that's the Bruce plan, it seems, in 1296. But once it's become clear that the English aren't on board with that, and really the English aren't on board with the concept of Scottish kingship at all. You know, they're still calling Scotland at this point the land of Scotland. Even in 1304, even though, you know, when the English have reoccupied, Edward, the English king, doesn't try to put as imposing a new English administration on the Scots. But again, he doesn't make any effort to try and reconcile with this notion of Scottish kingship. He's still determined that, you know, there's going to be a council basically that's going to run Scotland. And that's going to include now, in 1304, that's going to include some Scottish lords. So there's at least some part that the Scots get to play in sort of governing themselves. But there's going to be no king. You know, this council is going to be answerable to certain English officers, who are ultimately then answerable to the English crown. So by 1304, the only way that Bruce is ever going to get to be King of Scots is if he's king of an independent Scotland, because an English dominated Scotland isn't going to have a king, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And Bruce, the other group that interests other than Bruce and his allies, is the Scottish Church. A lot of the kind of ideological push for Scottish independence in this period comes from the church, because the church, the Scottish Church, considers itself to be the special daughter of Rome. They get to talk directly to the Pope. They don't have to go through any intermediaries or anything. If the English occupy Scotland, though, increasingly those Scottish clergymen are going to find themselves having to go via York, via, you know, Canterbury, via these big English houses, big English religious foundations, and the Scottish clergy don't like that. So, at the same time as Edward I is laying siege to Stirling Castle, which is the last castle in Scotland to fall, this is in July 1304, Bruce is to be found at nearby Cambus Kenneth Abbey, cutting a deal with William Lamberton, the Bishop of St. Andrews.
Okay.
Yeah, and the deal, the band, as it's known, is very carefully worded. It's, you know, expressed in terms of, you know, friendship and mutual support, and they're going to, you know, counsel one another and not undertake any serious, any serious actions without consulting the other and so on. But it is clear with hindsight, and certainly this is something that is used against Lamberton when he's captured by the English, having supported Bruce's kind of early bid for kingship. It's pretty clear that this is a band that's meant to kind of bring Lamberton on board with Bruce's bid for power.
Okay, so then he'd have the Church of Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. And when the time comes, we do see Robert Wishart, the Bishop of Glasgow, emerging as a very, very early supporter of Bruce. So it's quite likely that he too makes a similar deal with Bruce. The Abbot of Scone is present for Bruce's inauguration because it happens at Scone. Abbot of Inchaffray, or possibly Inchaffray, I'm never really sure how best to pronounce it, but it's an abbey in Perthshire. Both of them appear at Bruce's inauguration. So there's sort of, it would appear that after 1304, Bruce is bringing together these clergymen. It's also worth pointing out there's a letter from an Englishman at Berwick, sort of right on the border, still a Scottish town as far as anyone from Scotland is concerned in 1306. But in the aftermath, I think it's actually early 1307 this letter belongs to, but the writer complains of these wicked preachers that are sort of stirring up the Scots, common Scots in support of Bruce. That again would seem to suggest that there's probably a pretty big sort of clerical pool of support for Bruce, and this has probably been built up with the help of people like Lamberton and Wishart, on the basis that, you know, if they are willing to give support to Bruce, Bruce will, you know, make sure that the church is well treated and you know, their interests are taken care of in an independent Bruce-ruled Scotland.
So at this time, does the papacy need, I mean, I know that it's not necessarily the papacy's role, but would they try to accept Bruce? Would they, you know, put out a papal doctrine acknowledging him as the rightful king of Scotland?
Yeah, well, that is kind of where the controversy, it's a source of a great deal of controversy during Bruce's reign. So, the fact that Bruce kills his rival in a church doesn't really put the Pope in a particularly great frame of mind for dealing with Bruce. And he is excommunicated for having killed Comyn. He is then reconciled again in 1308, and is eventually excommunicated again in 1318, basically because again he's playing kind of fast and loose with the Pope. The Pope at that point has been trying to trying to arrange a truce between the Scots and the English. Because, I mean, you know, even by the time Bruce becomes king in 1306, this is a war that's been going on intermittently for 10 years. You know, by the time we hit sort of, you know, 1317, 1318, when Bruce is getting back in trouble with the Pope, it's now been going on over 20 years. And it still has another, what, 12 years or so to go after that. In sort of the late 1310, from about 1316, 1317, the Pope tries to get a truce arranged between the two sides. And Bruce strings the Pope along for a while, but eventually the Pope kind of he gets an unexpected opportunity to capture Berwick, and by doing that he is restoring the border as it had been before the war, so he kind of can't pass this up. But in doing so, he convinces the Pope, not unreasonably, that actually he hasn't really been all that interested in these truce talks after all, and so Bruce is excommunicated again, and he does get reconciled, but it is literally weeks before he dies, that he's reconciled that second time. But even when Bruce is reconciled, say in 1308, he's not immediately recognized by the Pope as King of Scots, because the Pope is constantly balancing his attitude towards Bruce with his attitude towards the English.
Okay.
So part of the reason that Bruce strings the Pope along for so long in the 1310s is that when the Pope writes to Bruce, he writes to him as Robert Bruce, Governor of Scotland. Won't call him King of Scots. There's a really interesting report. There are two papal legates who come to Britain, ostensibly this is in 1317, and they're ostensibly there to sort of collect money for crusading, essentially, but they do use the opportunity to visit the two royal courts and conduct kind of diplomatic business and so forth. And when they arrive at the Scottish court, they're made to wait for a long time. But when they do get to meet Bruce, they say, you know, he reacts very sort of well to them and seems very kind of friendly and welcoming and so forth. But he apparently says to them that he hasn't read these letters that came to Robert Bruce, Governor of Scotland, because there are other Robert Bruces in the kingdom, and collectively with the community of the realm, they're all governors of Scotland. So, you know, I can't open missives that aren't addressed directly to me, which kind of gives you a sense of where the kind of relationship between Bruce and the papacy is at that point. And it's kind of reflective of the relationship all through the reign. I mean, the Declaration of Arbroath, which is maybe the most famous document produced in Scotland, produced in 1320, is a letter to the Pope, John the 22nd, it is at this point, the same Pope who excommunicated him the second time. And it's ostensibly asking for reconciliation with the papacy. And of course, you know, in modern histories tend to focus on the more kind of patriotic side of things, you know, the famous thing about as long as 100 of us are alive, we'll, you know, never submit to English tyranny and so forth. I think the most interesting part of it is in the last paragraph. Even though this whole thing has been an exercise in trying to bring the Pope on side, the letter actually ends by saying, you know, and if you continue to listen to English lies and, you know, prejudice, these negotiations in their favor, then, you know, God's just going to blame you for all of the murdering and pillaging and burning and destruction that's going to go along with this war, because it's not going to stop. So, you know, even when Bruce is notionally going sort of cap in hand to the papacy, and the Scots are going cap in hand to the papacy at this point, there's still a kind of needle there. There's still a certain kind of irksome element to the relationship. But again, Bruce probably, to some extent, that you know, that I think can be explained by the fact that, you know, Bruce, whatever happens, still can count on the Scottish clergy to come to bat for him.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he does quite outrageous things like killing a rival in a church, because, you know, he knows that the church are invested in this notion of, you know, continued Scottish independence. And there's not really for those clergymen a, you know, a better option than Bruce. So, and I mean, he seems to have quite a good personal relationship with these folks. I mean, from what we can tell, you know, Wishart had been associated with the Bruces. The Bruces had been Earls of Carrick and Lords of Annandale before Bruce becomes King of Scots, both of which fall within the diocese of Glasgow. And the Bishop of Glasgow had come to bat for the Bruces. He'd been one of the auditors in favour of the Bruces during the succession crisis when the Bruces were putting forward their kind of legal case to be kings. Bishop Lamberton, the Bishop of St Andrews, you know, regular witness of the King's acts, you know, plays a big role both at court and also as a kind of diplomat abroad and so forth. So Bruce seems to be personally quite close with those guys. You know, his Chancellor is the Abbot of Arbroath, which is part of the reason why the Declaration of Arbroath is produced at Arbroath, because that's the royal chancery at that point. So all, you know, well, all most sort of official royal documents are being produced up in the northeast by Abbot Bernard of Arbroath. So you know, he can count on a lot of them personally, and you know, can count on the clergy more generally to go out to bat for him with his fellow Scots. So
is there any evidence that the murder of Thomas Comyn put any strain on these relationships for Bruce?
Well, see, that's kind of the interesting thing. There sort of isn't. So Comyn is killed on the 10th of February. Within about a month, Bruce immediately is, you know, packing castles, and you know, he makes an attack on some attacks on a few places, or his men do, to try and kind of establish physical control of as much of Scotland as he can. But within weeks, really less than a month of his killing of Comyn, he goes to Glasgow to visit Wishart, and Wishart absolves him. Wishart hears his confession and absolves him. He does have Bruce make an oath, essentially saying that he will ensure that the Scottish clergy have a say in the governance of the realm, that he'll rule essentially with the council of the church. But Wishart does absolve him of the sin of killing Comyn. Bishop Lamberton is physically down in England with the English king at the time of Comyn's murder. He absconds without permission to come north to celebrate Palm Sunday Mass for Bruce 2 days after Bruce's inauguration. It seems he doesn't get there in time for the inauguration. That happens on the 25th of March. But on the 27th, which happens to be Palm Sunday, he celebrates Palm Sunday Mass for Bruce. Like I say, the Abbot of Inchiffray and Chaffrey, the Abbot of Scone, they're all there for Bruce's inauguration. So this is kind of part of the reason for maybe thinking that Comyn's killing is something that Bruce has gone into, has gone to Dumfries, not, if not having planned for, then at least having anticipated might be an outcome. And knowing that even though he's going to have to do this in the church, that it'll kind of be okay. That the clergy will smooth things over for him, and he can just kind of tough it out. And
so at the time of the murder, was it a church service, or are they just meeting in the church, or
yeah?
Can you set that stage a little bit?
Yeah. So at the time, they seem to be in Dumfries for I think it's the sheriff court. I meant to look this up this morning and completely forgot about it. There's essentially, I mean, they're both, you know, they're both major regional lords in the southwest, so they're at Dumfries for kind of administrative reasons. There's a meeting of the sheriff court, and the meeting, it seems, is just arranged for the two to discuss. You know, it's a sort of, you know, it's a chin wag between the two of them. It's not mid service, and it's just them and maybe a few of their followers. But it's not, you know, and it's not a kind of official meeting.
Okay, so it wasn't like in the middle of a church service. I mean, we did a murder a couple episodes back where it was, I think it was the Medici's, where it was in the middle of the church service and they had an assassination attempt and people killed. So this was just, maybe his conversation didn't go the way he wanted and he had a backup plan and he knew he could rally the clergy around him. I mean, this is like super interesting to me because I'm getting a whole other picture of Robert the Bruce. I think he's Robert the Opportunist. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's really interesting though.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, this is the kind of awkward thing, is that none of the sources, we have a couple of more or less contemporary English sources, and then we have a couple of later Scottish sources. None of them give a really clear sense of exactly what the meeting is about. That's not entirely true. I mean, the English sources tend to emphasize this notion that Bruce got Common there to kill him. You know, the earliest account that we have says that, you know, Bruce was essentially jealous of Common's faithfulness to the English king, which I think we can reasonably say is just trying to, you know, blacken Bruce's reputation as much as possible. The Scottish sources claim that the two of them had an arrangement. Actually, they claim that there was an indenture, an actual written agreement, which seems unlikely given the subject matter. But essentially, that Common had agreed that Bruce could be king, that Common would support that. One of them actually suggests that the agreement was, well, if Bruce makes a bid, Common will support him. And if Common makes a bid for the throne, Bruce would support him. And that Common had ratted Bruce out to the English. And so Bruce gets him to Dumfries to confront him with this knowledge that, you know, I know what you did, Fredo, and then knifes him. Probably though, you know, I mentioned that, you know, for at least from 1304, Bruce has been getting the clergy on side. Probably from the same time, Bruce has been trying to gather as much of the sort of secular lords of Scotland as he can. And certainly there's quite a few of those rock up to Bruce's inauguration. So probably what has happened is by February 1306, Bruce is feeling confident enough in these networks that he's been building that he can finally broach the subject with Common. Probably this agreement doesn't exist before 1306, but possibly that's what Bruce wants to put on the table to Common at Dumfries, this notion that, you know, I want to be king.
Okay. And do we think that maybe Common doesn't support this, and so Bruce sees this as his only option?
Yeah. I think, you know, Bruce is gambling on this notion that Common... I mean, Common has a longer history of fighting against the English than Bruce, because, like I say, you know, Bruce changes sides in 1302, but Common sticks with it because, of course, you know, he's fighting to bring his kinsman Balliol back. So he's probably hoping that he can appeal to, you know, Common's patriotic sensibilities and so forth. But the problem is, Common hates Bruce for a start. I mean, they when they're serving as joint guardian in 1299, they hold a meeting at Peebles that ends with Common leaping across the table and seizing Bruce by the throat. So they already have quite the sort of history of violence. You know, they are big political rivals. They probably don't get on personally. The other issue is there's nothing really Bruce can offer Common that Common can't get without him.
Yeah, or doesn't already have.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you know, when Alor, like I say, Common had, had this history of resisting the English, when the English do take over again in 1304, I mean, Common is arrested and imprisoned for a wee while, but as the English are trying to sort of build their new administration in Scotland, increasingly they are looking to Common and his allies to support that. You know, the English are interested in reconciling with Common and his allies. So, you know, even in the sort of practical terms of getting to run things in Scotland, there's not much that Bruce can do to appeal to Common. And this is the thing. Common, by 1306, really is kind of the wait-and-see candidate. You know, they both know that Edward I is kind of old and past it. You know, he's not long for this world. You know, for Bruce, that, you know, presents the opportunity to seize things by the throat now, you know, when the English king isn't really in a position to do very much. For Common, that probably means sit back and, you know, see where the skittles land when Edward dies. You know, everything will be thrown up into the air again, maybe, so maybe this will be an opportunity to bring Balliol back now, or resume the fight to try and get Balliol back. Who knows? But, you know, Common is happy. You know, Common is on the up at this point. Mm-hmm. And so he's probably happy to wait and see. And when he tells Bruce that, or just tells Bruce to stick it, because like I say, these guys aren't friends. You know, even if Bruce has gone with this deal that he hopes is going to convince Common, after that, he has to know that Common can't leave.
Well, yeah, because Common's going to tell everybody and probably bring the English down on Bruce.
Exactly, exactly. So one way or another, Bruce has shown his cards. And it is better for because Common is so influential, it's so much for all it's going to cause, obviously, a lot of issues with, you know, well, you killed him in a church and so forth. It seems likely that the church is chosen because it's seen as kind of, you know, the most neutral ground you can get, somewhere where, you know, where you should be able to go in and expect not to just get knifed by the guy that you're meeting. So even though that raises a lot of kind of short and medium term problems for Bruce, things like the excommunication, in the long run, it is definitely better for Bruce to take Common off the table altogether. If he's not going to play, then you have to take him out of the game. And, you know, that as much as anything is why it is, you know, so John Barber, one of the guys who I did my PhD on, he is very loath ever to criticize the king, but even he admits that that Bruce misdid at that's the term that he uses, that he misdid in what he did with Common. And then he attributes a lot of the difficulties of Bruce's first sort of 18 months as king. You know, he loses the first two battles he fights. He ends up essentially on the run in his own kingdom. It's kind of touch and go as to whether, you know, he'll survive that first kind of year and a half or so of the reign. And Barber attributes that entirely to what, you know, this was the judgment of God against Bruce for what he did to Common in the church at Dumfries. But those problems are only magnified if Common is still out there. You know, to serve as a kind of English agent or even just an anti-Bruce agent within the community.
And Bruce didn't try to hide this either. He kind of acknowledged that he killed him that day.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, his that we are fortunate enough to have the text of the sort of reconciliation that the Pope makes with Bruce in 1308. It actually doesn't survive in its kind of original form, but it's transcribed by a mid 15th century Scottish chronicler called Walter Bower, and it even in that, you know, it is presented as if Bruce has essentially confessed to the Pope that yeah, I did this, and I, you know, I get that I shouldn't, but that I'm you know ready to, you know, perform whatever penance that you want, and it seems that it's just money to Paisley Abbey as far as we can, we can tell. But yeah, Bruce is kind of, you know, open and honest about it. It seems that the kind of Bruce propaganda is that there was a deal. Like I say, but there's John of Fordon who's writing in the 1360s, and then John Barber who's writing in the 1370s. Those are our two sort of earliest sources, Scottish sources. And they do sort of broadly agree that there was a deal that Comyn had reneged on, and you know that was why he kind of deserved to die. You know, yes, it was bad where Bruce did it. Maybe he could have, you know, could have thought that one through better. But you know that, you know, I mean, this is the interesting thing about all of the sources. We have kind of four really main sort of contemporary and near contemporary sources leading up to sort of, you know, Barber obviously writing some 60 years after the event, but it would seem drawing on kind of earlier sources and certainly reflecting that kind of that early tradition that the Bruce Scots maintain about what happened and why. All of them agree that Bruce went there planning to kill Comyn.
Okay.
It's not until later that we get this notion that it's a kind of crime of passion, which is, I mean, it's believable enough. Like I say, they have this fight at Peebles in 1299. You know, they're both tough and hardy guys. Both of them by this point have, you know, a good, you know, best part of a decade of, you know, military experience behind them, and have, you know, been training to fight probably since they were seven. So it's not absurd to suggest that this was just a, you know, a meeting gone wrong and somebody said the wrong thing and they said about each other. But the earliest sources that we have are all in agreement that this was planned. The English say that it was planned because, you know, Bruce was a wrong'un. You just, you know, didn't like Comyn, didn't like the English, etc., etc. And the Bruce, but you know, the Bruce Scots maintain that, well, you know, Comyn was a wrong'un and, you know, got what was coming to him just in, you know, an awkward venue. Yeah. But yeah, there's no attempt to hide it. It seems right from the start. Like I say, he goes to Bishop Wishart and you know confesses, and you know Wishart makes a big deal of making it clear that, you know, whatever the Pope might be saying, that God forgives Bruce and that, you know, it'll all come out in the wash sooner or later. I kind of think that probably speaks to it being part of the plan, that there have been discussions about, you know, how does the sort of PR side of this, how is that going to be handled when the time comes. You know, everybody will leave that meeting hoping that Comyn's gonna play ball, but knowing what the consequences are if he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. I actually hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah. So much more crime of passion versions can be seen in Outlaw King, the Chris Pine Robert the Bruce film. And anybody willing to sit through about 15 minutes of credits will see my name misspelled as a historical consultant, one less L than it has in real life. And you'll also find it in the Robert the Bruce, the Angus McFadden Robert the Bruce film, featuring what's he called? Thingy Harris is Jared Harris as John Common.
Interesting, yeah. And you've also talked about Robert the Bruce on the BBC as well, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. In Rise of the Clans. Yeah. And again, as is, I think, usual for more sort of modern presentations of the big event, it too leans towards that notion that it's this kind of crime of passion, that it's, you know, supposed to be a civil conversation and it gets out of hand and then Bruce goes for him. But I think often those interpretations rely on a kind of fondness for Bruce. Mm-hmm. You know, what I was going to say there was, I think people think it speaks badly of Bruce's character. I think it probably does. You know, if he did go into like kill him, but I don't know. I obviously am phenomenally interested in Robert the Bruce. I think he's a really fascinating character. I have worked on him on the PhD. I also work on him in my actual job. But I also don't think that precludes us from appreciating that he was a bit of a dubious figure, morally speaking, and that his actions were much more motivated by what suited his interests at the time rather than, you know, fitting into the later kind of heroic image that has grown up around him.
Yeah.
No, I find it really interesting to hear this facet of it. I'll watch the movies, I'll do that, but I haven't delved as deep as obviously you have. And it is really fascinating to see kind of that backstory, the behind the scenes on what people are really like. And I think if we look at almost anybody in history, if you dig a little deeper, you're going to find out some stuff that maybe you didn't want to know, depending on your position. And the other thing, I mean, listening to this, Bailey and Common and Bruce, it really seems like sometimes people are really short-sighted, and you know, their ultimate goal was targeting the English, and maybe if they had gotten together and they could have done something more productive with the English, and then they could have sorted it out later. But that's all hindsight, you know. But this is all super interesting. I'm going to have to read some more, because this is I really enjoyed what you talked about.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, and we'd love to have you on another time. Thank you for listening to Medieval Murder. If you have any listener questions, comments, or topic suggestions, please feel free to reach out via our Twitter account, @MurderMedieval, our Instagram account, @MedievalMurder, or via email at info.medievalmurder@gmail.com. And do you want to share some of your social media or your blog?
You can find me on Twitter, mostly just pulling out random funny bits of Scottish history as and when I think of them, at vivstan211240, which I'm eternally ashamed of the handle. It sounds like a bot, but it was because I made it at a time before I realized it was going to be a professional Twitter handle, and now I'm frightened that if I change it, nobody will be able to find me again.
Yeah.
And I do also run a blog, Night of the Two L's. You'll find it on Blogger. And it again covers all sorts of events from Scottish history, usually done to match up with anniversary dates. There are blogs on the murders that we've talked about here for anyone that wants to see even more. And there are all sorts of battles and marriages and occasionally some happy things happening, but it's mostly the Grim and Grisly side.
Yeah. Tune in 2 weeks for our next podcast.